everybody to this Rothschild Visiting Professor lecture. I'm very pleased to welcome Hans Teustermack to the Institute and as our Rothschild Visiting Professor on the Discrete Integrable Systems program. Hans has a very distinguished record. He was appointed as a full professor in Utrecht, according to the CV that we had, at the age of 32. And he's made lots of contributions into maths, and not just into maths as a subject, but also into the mathematics community as well. So we're really grateful that he has agreed to be our Rothschild professor, and we're looking forward to his talk on purity maps and elliptic surfaces. And the only other thing that I have to say is, for those of you who haven't heard me say it, this is the Newton standard hour, and by definition it computes exactly 1 hour, and normally the speaker stops towards the end of that period or shortly thereafter. Anyway, hands over to you, and thank you very much.
Thank you. So let me first explain the words in the title of the talk. QRT map originated maybe not in the way I present it, but the way I present it, I think, is the easiest to understand what these things are about. One starts out with a biquadratic polynomial, which means a polynomial in two variables. And biquadratic means that if you keep the variable y, for instance, fixed, and you view the polynomial as a function of x, then it is a second order polynomial, a quadratic polynomial. And biquadratic means that the same holds true if you do it the other way around. If you keep x fixed, then as a function of y, it is a quadratic polynomial. So then this immediately leads to the following nice construction, which I would like to call the QRT map on the biquadratic curve for the given biquadratic polynomial. So your biquadratic curve, by definition, is the curve given by the equation P of x, y equal to 0, where P is the biquadratic polynomial. So you get a curve in the plane. And now you use the fact that if y is constant, taken to be a constant value, then you are on a horizontal axis. And the equation Px(y) equal to 0 as an equation for x has two solutions, as you know. But that means that this horizontal axis on the level y intersects the curve in exactly two points. And now you look at the involution, which switches these two intersection points. And you do it for every level y, and that gives you an involution of the whole curve to itself. And this I would like to call the horizontal switch on the curve. But since the same property holds if you keep x fixed, and then you get a vertical axis, and then again the vertical axis intersects, each vertical axis intersects the curve in exactly two points, and you can interchange those two points, and you get in this way the vertical switch still on this curve. So this is, now we have already two involutions on this curve. As a dynamical system, one involution is not very interesting, because if you iterate this map, you do it twice, you get the identity, and so not much happens. But if you compose the two involutions, so first do the horizontal switch and then the vertical switch, then you get a much more interesting transformation of the curve to itself. And this composition of the horizontal switch with the vertical switch I call the QRT map of the biquadratic curve, defined by the biquadratic curve. Now I will try to make use of these two overhead projectors that while I'm talking, then you can once in a while look at the second one too. Where is it? Oh, it's upside down. So. Now, there's one property about biquadratic curves which I need to explain, because it tells you what the map is doing on the bichoretic curve. So what I do is I make use of the Hamiltonian vector field, which is given by dx dt is equal to partial derivative of p with respect to y, dy dt is equal to minus the partial derivative of p with respect to x. This Hamiltonian vector field has the nice property that the flow defined by this dynamical system, this flow leaves the level curves of p invariant. P is constant along the solutions of this Hamiltonian system. In particular, our bichoretic curve p equal to 0 is invariant under this flow. Now, there's one other observation which one can immediately make about Hamiltonian, about this Hamiltonian system, namely that at a point where the curve p equal to 0 is smooth, that means exactly that the gradient of p does not vanish at every point of the curve. But that means that this vector field has no zeros. So you have a vector field on the curve without zeros. And that means that the flow really runs around. There are no equilibrium points. That's the first observation. But now the second observation is that this still holds true if you compactify the plane in which the curve is defined. So you look at not at C cross C, but at P1 cross P1, complex projective line, Cartesian product with complex projective line. So then you add points at infinity, and you have to use a computation of the vector field in affine coordinates near infinity, and you verify that the same still holds true, which is a bit remarkable, because in general, if you do these coordinate changes to look at points at infinity, it means that you replace x by 1 over x, and you think that you introduce all kinds of singular behavior. But the vector field remains smooth even at the points at infinity, and if the point at infinity is a smooth point of the curve, then also you get a nice non-zero vector field there. Non-zero smooth vector field. So on the whole curve in the projective plane, P1 cross P1, you have this non-zero vector field. So now we have a complex analytic curve, which is moreover compact. And on it, we have this action of C, because I viewed also the time as being complex. So I have a complex, I have an action of C viewed as an additive group. So you have this flow on this compact curve. And because the vector field is non-zero, the orbits of this flow are open. And because because the whole curve is the disjoint union of the orbits, and because the curve is connected, that's easy to check, you get that there is only one orbit. And that means that you can use the time parameter to parameterize the whole curve. Yeah? So that is, so put in more precise way, the bichoretic curve is isomorphic to C modulo P, where capital P is the period lattice. Because, of course, if you return back after some time to the same point, then on the curve, these are the same points, although the times are different. So you have to work modulo the period lattice. You immediately conclude also that the period lattice must be a rank 2 lattice in the complex plane, because otherwise you would not get a compact quotient. Yeah? And from the real point of view, this looks like R2 modulo Z2, so it is just a real two-dimensional torus. But I like to view it really as a complex curve with this complex structure on it coming from this complex time. So this complex time is automatically the natural parameterization of this curve. And now this fact that the curve is isomorphic to C modulo a period lattice can be also phrased as the curve has genus 1, that means it is an elliptic curve. And so the conclusion is that a biquadratic curve, whenever it is smooth, it's automatically an elliptic curve. Now these elliptic curves, this map, this QRT map which I had on it, is an automorphism of this elliptic curve, and there are not so many automorphisms of elliptic curves. They are either inversions, meaning that the time is reversed, or they are translations. There's not much else. And it's quite easy to verify that in this case of the QRT map, the map actually is a translation in this time variable. And that means that the problem is solved in some sense, namely that we have this elliptic curve, which is a real two-dimensional torus, which you can think of a clock like that, not like like that one, a clock where each of the hands is running around on a circle, and those are the two R mod Z components, and transformation just shifts both arms over a fixed time, and that's what the transformation is doing. So we understand very well what the transformation is doing on this biquadratic curve. But this is not quite what Crispell and Roberts and Thompson were doing. They had a map from the whole plane to itself, not just on one curve. And so what they did is they gave themselves not only one biquadratic polynomial, but they gave themselves two linearly independent ones, which I denote by P upper 0 and P upper 1. So these are both biquadratic polynomials, and then you take an arbitrary linear combination, and I just take the next letter in the alphabet for taking these coefficients as coefficients, and then I look at the corresponding biquadratic curve. And here Z0 and Z1 are just arbitrary complex numbers. Of course, not both equal to 0, because then you get the whole plane back, and that's not what I want. I want to really have a curve. And now we are going to make some very intelligent remarks. First remark is that if Z0 and Z1 are both multiplied with the same factor, then the curve is the same. So the curve is not parametrized by two variables, but actually by only one variable, namely the variable which tells you what is the one-dimensional linear subspace of the two-dimensional space spanned by Z0 and Z1. That is what parametrizes the family. And so the space of all one-dimensional linear subspaces of the two-dimensional space, that's just a projective line. So you get a projective line of curves, if you allow me this way of saying. So a projective line of curves. And in algebraic geometry, which is not actually my field, but which I had to learn in order to understand more about these QRT maps, this is called a pencil of curves. And I think that it comes from this idea that a projective line can be thought of as a straight line. But I don't like that, because for me, the one-dimensional linear subspaces, they turn around, and they are more like a fan. And that's the Dutch word for pencil of curves. But in any case, so you have a one-parameter family of curves, and they fill the plane. And let me explain why that is the case. There are two alternatives. First alternative is that there is for a point x, y. So fix now for the moment x, y, point x, y in the plane. Then there are two alternatives. Either both polynomials vanish at that point, And if that happens, then this is zero for every choice of z0 and z1. And that means that all the curves are going through that same point. So this is called a base point of the pencil. And the local picture is precisely like I drew here. This is the point, base point B, let's say, and all the curves pass through that same one and the same point. The other alternative is, for given x, y, that this here is not true. That's the other alternative. And that means not both zero, then the set of all z0, z1s for which this holds is a one-dimensional linear subspace of the two-dimensional space, and therefore is a unique point of this projective line. Put in another way, for all other points in the plane, there is a unique curve which passes through it, a unique member of the pencil which passes through it. So in this sense, these curves fill the plane. But there are these funny points where all the curves pass through. And they are unavoidable if you work over the complex numbers and projectively. And you have to do that, because otherwise you can have that these intersection points run away to infinity and things like that. So you better look at this complexification. And you also need to work over the complex numbers, because you know that quadratic equations, the discriminant can be negative. And if you work over the reals, then you wouldn't have any solutions at all. So that's a reason for putting myself in this framework. This is not to say that the real case is not interesting. The real case is very interesting. But what I'm trying to convey here is that the theory over the complex numbers and projectively, that theory is much more uniform than when you work over the real numbers. And so the advice is, first do the theory over the complex numbers and projectively, and then when you are interested in real questions, then look at how the complex conjugation acts on everything, and then the real points are just the fixed points of the complex conjugation, and that is the natural way to treat real questions. In general, classifications for the real objects are much more complicated than the classifications in the complex situation. The complex situation is more uniform. So, but in any case, if you have two biquadratic polynomials, then the x, y are the common zero set of both polynomials. So you look at the intersection points of the two biquadratic curves defined by this one and by that one. And it is just a matter of fact that the intersection number of two biquadratic curves is equal to 8. And that means that there are 8 base points of the pencil, if you count them with multiplicities. The intersection number I'm talking about is the intersection number of intersection theory, which is even a homology invariant. If you replace the curve by a cycle which is homologous to the curve, then the intersection number doesn't change. So that's a very strong invariance property of this intersection number. So here is an example of a pencil where you have, even if you draw everything in the real plane, I mean, pictures I can only make in the real plane. C cross C is too big to draw. But in the real plane, you get such a pencil. Now, it can happen very easily that some of the base points are not real, that you get complex conjugate base points. If, for instance, all the coefficients are real, then still it can happen that you don't see any base points in the real picture. So this here I've chosen an example where you where all the 8 base points are happen to be real. So you can count them. You see them. If you see such a picture, you're your eye is immediately drawn to these base points. So I don't even have to say more where they are lying. You will agree with me that this is immediately clear. So now, when you have such a one-parameter family of such biquadratic curves, then the whole situation becomes suddenly much more interesting. Because for each smooth curve of the family, the QRT map on that curve acts like a translation. That doesn't sound too interesting. But what you now can ask is, how does this translation depend on the parameter which tells you on which curve you are? You understand the sentence? Yeah. Okay. Then there is another fact. Among these members of the pencil, there are always members which are not smooth, which are singular, which have singularities. And it is a fact that, again, counted with multiplicities, there are 12 singular members in the pencil. And so what you then can ask, if the curves which approach a singular one, what is the translation doing on those curves when you approach the singular one? And how does the map act on the singular one? Actually, does it map act on the singular one? A very bad example, for instance, would be if you take for your biquadratic curve a curve which has a horizontal axis as one of the irreducible components. That can happen. Then you have this kind of a picture. Then on this part of the curve, the horizontal switch is well defined, but on this horizontal axis, which is also part of the curve, the horizontal switch is not defined at all. So what do you mean here by the QRT map? Okay. So now comes the next picture. Sorry, let me move this over so that you can look at the pencil with all the nice colors. Can you see the colors, by the way? Yeah? Okay, very nice. So now the idea which is very old in algebraic geometry, dates back to the 19th century, the Italian geometers used it all the time, is that if you see such a base point, then what you can do is you can replace the surface by another smooth surface, which is isomorphic to the surface you start out with over the complement of this point, of this unique point, but such that this, in the new surface, this point has been replaced by the complex projective line of all one-dimensional linear subspaces of the tangent space at that point. And this process is called blowing up. So the statement is that you have a surface S, and over it is hanging another surface, S prime, in which such that if you take, and there is a downward projection, that's called pi, such that over the complement of this point, this pi is an isomorphism, whereas the fiber over that special base point of this map is a whole complex projective line. So it's very strange. This is not a branched covering where you have over each point finitely many originals and that some of them come together at the branch points. This is very different. Here it is isomorphism over the complement of the point, and over that base point B, you have a whole complex projective line. So you might think that this is such a violent transformation that it is impossible to make a smooth surface which is doing this. I mean, you can of course take your surface and you just add this bubble to the point, but that's not smooth if you do it in that stupid way. So let me convince you by a picture of the real situation. This is again a real picture of the complex blowing up. let me convince you that you really get a smooth surface. So what this is simply you take all these one-dimensional linear subspaces which go through the base point, and now you separate them by putting them on different levels. So what you get is a rotating family of one-dimensional linear subspaces at different levels. And this is hanging over the original plane, and you see that it is a nice smooth surface, and that this point corresponds to this vertical axis over it, whereas over the complement of the point this is an isomorphism. That's also completely obvious from the way you make it. This picture is not quite correct, because if you have rotated a half turn, then the one-dimensional linear subspace has returned to itself. And therefore, the bottom line in the upstairs picture has to be identified with the top line. And if you do that, then you see that you have the Möbius strip, which is a beautiful smooth surface and projects down in this very funny way. So this is called blowing up. The point downstairs has been blown up to a projective line. In the complex situation, everybody knows that the Möbius strip is topologically non-trivial, whereas the plane itself is topologically trivial. A similar thing happens in the complex situation. Blowing up a point on the surface makes that the new surface is topologically more complicated. And in the complex setting, this comes from the fact that the new projective line, which has been added, turns out to have self-intersection number equal to -1 in terms of homology. So you can take this curve and replace the curve by a cycle, but now in the real sense, a real two-dimensional cycle, which intersects the curve nicely transversely. And then you count the intersection points with orientation, and the number is -1. And since this intersection number is a homology invariant, this is well defined, doesn't depend on the choice of the way I perturbed this curve. So the curve, the projective line which you have added, adds to the homology a non-trivial object, because if it would be homologically trivial, then every intersection number with every other cycle would be 0. And this is not the case here. So you really have made the surface more complicated by just replacing this one point by this complex projective line. In the complex setting, this perturbation which I was talking about is actually not possible. The theorem is that if you take any other complex analytic curve, which is homologous as a cycle to this curve which has self-intersection -1, then it is equal to that curve. So you cannot really perturb the thing in a complex analytic way. But in topology, you are allowed to take real two-dimensional cycles any way you like. So there, this intersection number is well defined. Of course, the algebraic geometers don't do it that way, but that doesn't hurt. I have to look a little bit where I am now. Yeah. So you will. So, looking at the picture, you immediately see that if you have a base point like that, where all the curves go through in such a way that the tangent lines nicely move, then by blowing up that point, you separate the curves, and you get a new surface where the curves become disjoint. So if I blow up all the base points, assuming that all the base points are simple, meaning that they have this kind of intersection pattern, so that then you have to blow up 8 times, Then you get a new surface, which is topologically more complicated, still compact, smooth, everything you like, but in which the members of the pencil I started out with now have been made disjoint. So they form a vibration of the surface. The whole surface is the disjoint union of this one parameter family of curves. But it is not a vibration in the sense of locally trivial, because there are some fibers which are singular. 12 of them, I already mentioned. So it is a vibration in which singularities of fibers are allowed. That is the kind of thing which you get. Before I go on, I must also mention that you can have multiple base points. And multiple base points are characterized by the remarkable fact that the curves which pass through it, that all the curves which pass through it are smooth at that point, except one. So only one member of the family is not smooth at that point. So there's precisely one member of the family which has a singularity at that point. And in this picture, an example is shown where this happens. The cross consisting of the horizontal and the vertical axis, that is one member of the pencil, and it has a singular point, normal crossing, at this base point. All the other members of the pencil are smooth at that point. But at the same time, the other members of the pencil are tangent to each other. They have the same tangent. So they have contact of order 2 in this picture. And now you understand also what the multiplicity of the base point means geometrically. It is the order of contact between all the curves passing through the point. Yeah. For this example. So what happens here is that if you blow up once, let me make a picture. This is the pencil with that base point. If you now blow up once, then you get the exceptional curve which replaces this point. But you have a unique tangent line, and that corresponds to a unique point here, because this is the set of tangent lines, if one-dimensional linear subspaces of the tangent space here. And they all have the same tangent line, so there is a unique point here. And if you lift the curves to the surface above, then you get a simple crossing, like that. So the blow-up makes that the base point of multiplicity 2 has been replaced by a base point of multiplicity 1. So every blow-up improves the situation. But that means, since we have 8 base points counted with multiplicity, even if you have multiple base points, after 8 blow-ups, all base points have disappeared, and you get the nice smooth surface with the vibration. This picture is one of the explicit examples in the literature. I found many examples in the literature, and so I prefer to make all my pictures with one of the known famous examples from the literature. This just very quickly, this was what I was chalking on the blackboard. Here you have multiplicity 2, multiplicity 1, and here the base point has disappeared and the curves have become nicely disjoint. Oh, another thing which is clearly shown by this picture, at the end of the process you still have the P1, the exceptional curve, which was created in the last blow-up. And so what you see from the picture very clearly, that all the members of the pencil are intersected by that curve. And that means that this P1, which you get from the last blow-up, is a global section of the vibration. it intersects each of the curves in exactly one point. So you can use it actually also as an alternative geometric parameterization of the family of curves, by just telling where at which point it intersects. Now I think a talk in mathematics would not be complete if I wouldn't have a theorem in it. So I dare to show a theorem to you. Oh. So let me first hold it and read it. The theorem says, given a pencil of biquadratic curves with at least one smooth member, of course that is needed, otherwise you don't get... No, it doesn't. Doesn't quite. Yeah. Doesn't matter. Then after the blowing up of the base points 8 times, you obtain a nice smooth surface called a rational elliptic surface. And now comes the main point. We had this on each of the curves, we had this translation, at least when the curves were smooth. But the point now is that although there still could be places where the QRT transformation was not well defined, in this upstairs smooth manifold, the transformation, which certainly is defined in a dense open subset, extends to a globally defined diffeomorphism of the surface. So everywhere, well-defined, complex analytic with a complex bijective with a complex analytic inverse. You name all the adjectives. It's really an automorphism of this complex analytic surface. Then, furthermore, on each smooth fiber, which is an elliptic curve, this automorphism acts as a translation. So what you get is very interesting kind of compact analytic surfaces, not shared by the arbitrary compact analytic surfaces, namely that on it you have automorphisms. You have this vibration, where the smooth fibers are elliptic curves, and on it you have this transformation given by the biquadratic pencil I started out with, defined in terms of that, which acts on each smooth fiber as a translation. So you get a very nice subgroup of the automorphism group of the surface. So if you have such an elliptic surface, then these automorphisms, which act on S by translations on the smooth fibers, they form a group, the set of all these form a group, and that is called the Mordell-Weil group, of the surface S. This is not quite the definition in the literature, but it's equivalent to the definition in the literature. So now comes another surprise. If you have a so-called rational elliptic surface, meaning that it is birational equivalent to the complex projective plane, and that is the case in for the ones which appear from the QRT construction. If you have such a thing, and if it has such an automorphism, which moreover has the property that if you take a section E, which in the case of QRT could be obtained by taking this P1, which appears in the last blow-up, that was a section, you apply the transformation, let's call it tau, to it, you get another section. Now, for the QRT map, it's very easy to see that it maps the section to a disjoint one. There are no, you see, they leave the fibers invariant, so if this is the fiber, which is intersected by these sections, each of them once, then this point is really moved. There are no fixed points for the QRT transformation. So if tau of E does not intersect E, that it really moves all the points of, then there's also a converse. So starting with a rational elliptic surface and an element tau of this Mordaval group, which maps a section to a disjoint one, then it is the QRT map of some biquadratic tensor. This is a very strong conclusion. Yeah. And I must emphasize here that here there is one of the problems which I do not really understand. Namely, it can very well happen that if you have two very different looking biquadratic pencils, it can happen that the corresponding rational elliptic surfaces are isomorphic to each other, and that even the maps are conjugate to each other by the isomorphism. So what I'm actually trying to say is I do not know a classification of all the biquadratic tensors which could give rise to the same rational elliptic surface. You can look at the most generic situations, for instance, when all the singular fibers are irreducible. That is sort of the generic situation. And in that case, I can, using homological arguments, I can find the number of non-isomorphic biquadratic tensors which give rise to the same isomorphism class of rational elliptic surface. That number is very high, a few thousand. So there are a few thousand non-isomorphic ones, biquadratic tensors, which give rise to the same rational elliptic surface. But this is a statement about the generic situation. And one thing which I learned in a very early stage is that all the interesting examples in the literature are highly non-generic. And so if in your favorite example you would like to try to find this number, I have no idea, actually. Yeah. Oh, I should mention the name of Manin, who developed this, not starting with pencils of biquadratic curves, but with pencils of cubic curves in the complex projective plane. There you can do similar things. But the nice thing about pencils of biquadratic curves is that the transformation comes automatically with the pencil. It's automatically defined in terms of the pencil, which is not the case for pencils of cubic curves. There you need some additional knowledge to construct the map. Here comes another theorem, and I promise that after that I no more theorems. There are lots of theorems. So I prefer to give only very few of the theorems, because if I want to make it representative, I would do theorem in very high rate, and you wouldn't be able to follow me. So here comes another theorem, which I like very much. Suppose that the pencil has the property, first, of course, that it has at least one smooth member, but secondly, that no member contains a horizontal axis or a vertical axis. So this kind of situation is excluded now for the moment. And then the statement is the following. Fix a positive integer k. Yeah. And then look at the parameter values, which tell you on which curve you are. So look at those curves, such that on that curve, the transformation is periodic of period k. That means that the k-th iterate of the transformation on that curve is the identity mapping. For translations, you have the remarkable fact that if you look at the k-th iterate of the map, if it leaves one point of our torus fixed, then it leaves every point of the torus fixed. Translations do have this remarkable property, which is called the Poncelet property. Poncelet was, by the way, a very interesting guy. He was a Frenchman, early 19th century, who was captured by the Russians in the campaign of Napoleon against Russia. And in captivity, he created very interesting deep mathematics. And so when he came back to France, he wrote it down in several books. And so he used his captivity extremely well. So now the statement is that if you fix the positive integer k and you look at the curves on which the map has period k, then there are k squared minus 1 such curves. Exactly k squared minus 1. This is a bit funny. And the proof of that is based on the action for the proof uses the action of the map on the homology group of homology classes of real two-dimensional cycles. And among those you have the complex analytic curves. They are real two-dimensional cycles. And you look at the action of the map on this cohomology group. This cohomology group is isomorphic as a group to z to the power 10, because this group for P1 cross P1 is isomorphic to z squared. And with each blow-up, you add a non-trivial two-cycle. And so this rank goes up with each blow-up. So you get this thing. But the main point is that on this group, you have the intersection number of cycles. This is defined on homology classes because intersection number is a homology invariant. So on this lattice, you also have this integral-valued symmetric bilinear form defined by taking the intersection number of two cycles. And it is really using the intersection theory which enables me to find this number. Because the argument is the following. Now I make a picture like that, but not for tau, but for its k-th iterate. So here we have this section E, and then now we look at the k-th iterate of tau applied to E. And since the map is a translation on the fibers, you see immediately that the fixed fibers correspond exactly, bijectively, so to speak, with the intersections of that image of this section with the section you start out with. And you have a fixed point of tau to the power k if and only if this thing intersects it. See, if this happens for one point on this fiber, then it's automatically the identity on the whole fiber through that point by this Poncelet principle, which I just And that means that this number of k-periodic fibers is actually equal to the intersection number of this cycle with that cycle. But since the intersection number is a homology invariant, you can compute it as soon as you know the action of tau on this lattice. Yeah? Now, you, under this assumption which I made there, the action on this lattice can be explicitly written down. It's like a linear transformation in this 10-dimensional space. And it turns out that this linear transformation is of the form identity plus nilpotent, where the third power of the nilpotent matrix is already equal to zero. And if you have such a situation, then you can make a little calculation. Let me do it here. 1 plus n to the power k is equal to the identity plus k times n plus k times k minus 1 times n squared, and nothing else. And so I only need to know what is the intersection number of n, the n image of E, and the intersection number of n squared image of E, and then I know the intersection number for all k. You also see from this formula that you always get quadratic behavior in k. Now, if this assumption is not fulfilled, then actually you have the following theorem, that a finite power of the map, still on this homology, still is of this form. And so you first have to iterate the map a given number of times, and after that, it behaves like that. So this power will behave like that. So what you will get is that in general, the number of k-periodic fibers is of the order k squared, but it is actually a rational number times k squared plus something which behaves periodically with period equal to this power which is needed in order to make it of that form, if you understand what I mean. Okay. And this this latter thing follows from a beautiful paper of Oguiso and Shioda in 1991. So these are the two theorems I wanted to convey. I'm pretty happy that I managed some of the theorems to tell you about them. Now we get some more pictures. So let me first show you the picture. Can I put it like that? Yeah. Oh. Doesn't help. You can look upside down. Yeah. So what is drawn here is the complex plane of parameter values telling you on which curve you are. And I have chosen myself a number k in the order of magnitude of something like 100, because then you get 10,000 points, which correspond to k-periodic action of the map. Yeah? Those are those curves on which the map has period k. And I just draw them by marking those points. And is the picture good, well visible? Yeah. So if you stare a little bit at the picture, then you see that these points, they are not just randomly distributed, but they arrange themselves in a sort of curvy linear lattice. Yeah. Now, I confront you with the picture, and then you can start thinking of a proof why this is true. And it will not be too hard, actually. because with myself it went the other way around. I first asked myself, when k becomes large, can I understand the asymptotics of this collection of values for which you have k periodicity? Can I find, at least for k running to infinity, the asymptotic behavior of this set of points? So once I asked myself the question, it was next just a matter of applying quite straightforward asymptotic analysis to get the asymptotic formulas. And then I realized that from that asymptotic formulas, the set of these points should look like a curvilinear lattice. And so then I wanted to have this visible in a picture, and so this is how it came about. Now this picture is about a very specific example of a biquadratic of a QRT map, which is actually one of the classical ones way before Crispell, Roberts, and Thompson introduced this, and that is the billiard map. Is there an eraser? Oh, here, lots of erasers. Very good. So I have to explain to you what the billiard map is to give at least one classical example. It's the elliptic billiard. So you have a billiard table which is not a rectangle, but the boundary is an ellipse. And then an ellipse has two focal points. And if you have the two focal points, you have the confocal quadrics, like that. But you also have confocal quadrics, like that. So you have a family of confocal quadrics. Now comes a theorem, which is very classical, actually. One knows that if you have an orbit of the billiard ball which passes through the focal point and then you reflect it with equal angles, then it goes through the other focal point. That is where the name focal point comes from. And it focuses perfectly for an ellipse. But there is a very nice, more general statement about the arbitrary orbits of the billiard ball. Billiard ball is by definition that it bounces like that and then it continues. And the statement is as follows, that for each trajectory, there is a unique confocal quadric such that the trajectory is tangent to that quadric, to that other quadric, and after bouncing, it is again tangent. And after bouncing, it is again tangent, and so on, and so forth. The same quadric, the same confocal quadric. So all the orbits, they are nicely fibered, so to speak, into, there is a parameter telling you which confocal quadric you have. And so you get a one parameter family of such orbits. And each of these orbits corresponding to this confocal quadric themselves forms a one parameter family. Yeah, because you can take the initial point, another point, and then make the tangent and do the construction. That is the situation. So now comes the explanation of this picture in terms of biquadratic stuff. You look at the configuration of initial point on the outer quadric and line in the plane through that point. This could be called the incidence relation, if you like, but with the point on the outer quadric. And then after bouncing, you get a new initial point and a new line. Now, if you look at this from the point of view of this point, then you see that this is an involution of this quadric. And since, and this is also an involution, that this is from line to line, but this is also an involution. If you fix the line, then this is an involution. So you have two different involutions, and they combine to give the billiard transform, if you understand what I mean, the billiard map. So the billiard map is a composition of two involutions, and then it is not hard actually to find the corresponding biquadratic tensor to which this is equivalent. And so this is the picture of these k-periodic points for billiard map, where these points, they correspond to the singular fibers of the elliptic vibration. And they are very, very visible in the picture. The whole asymptotics becomes entirely different near those singular points. And in a very strange way. For instance, here you see that the points arrange them along circles. And if you let k run to infinity, the circles become astronomically small, of the order of magnitude e to the power minus constant times k. So you cannot really picture them anymore. The points farther away from these singular points, they are at a distance from each other of order 1 over k. So that is not too bad. But near the singular points, the whole behavior is very different. And also, this arrangement in circles is something which I have never seen before. You see, I'm used, actually, to looking at joint spectra of operators, differential operators, two differential operators, and then you have a joint spectrum, and that's also such a cloud of points. And then you can have, for instance, Planck's constant in the whole setup. You let Planck's constant go to zero, and you get again a sort of curvilinear lattice where the distance between the lattice points is of order h. But there again, you can have singular points where the asymptotics is different. The asymptotics at those singular points of those Schrödinger type of equations is extremely different from what happens here. So that was for me another fascination of the subject, that also there's an analytic side to it, which I think is very interesting. And so I would like to stop here.
Thank you very much, Hans. A very nice talk. Any questions? Yes, please.
Yeah, I'd like to know if the QRT map can be a finite order. Can the QRT,
oh, yes, sure.
And can you calculate the order in terms of the original data?
The orders, Professor Tsuda is here in the audience, actually, who first looked more carefully at finite order QRT maps. The order can be only 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6. And for each of these orders, if the whole map is periodic.
Did you say 5?
Yeah, 5 is included. Yeah, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6. And then for each of these orders, you can try to classify. And one can go a long way in finding which QRT maps. For instance, the number of free parameters still around in choosing such maps can be determined. For essential parameters, for instance, order 2 has 5 essential parameters still left, whereas the arbitrary QRT map has 8 essential parameters left. You can also make more fancy language and say that the moduli space of isomorphism classes of QRT maps is 8-dimensional, but the subvariety of order 2 QRT maps is 5-dimensional. And for instance, period 5 and 6, up to isomorphisms, they are unique. So they are you can point at one and say all the others are isomorphic to this one. That's for 5 and 6. And so this is has been investigated in quite some detail. Very good question.
Any other questions? And this is fascinating, but to an outsider like me, they seem a little bit still like curiosities, amazing curiosity. I mean, do they? but curiosities can sometimes, you know, reveal big things. Is there any evidence that this is going to reveal a big thing?
The QRT maps in themselves, I'm not so sure whether they reveal really big things. But my personal experience, from my personal experience, it definitely revealed big things. Because in order to understand really what is happening with these QRT maps, I had to look at these elliptic surfaces. And so I learned about Kodaira's theory of elliptic surfaces, which is a very nice theory, actually. And that is part. This is part of the title. Where is the title here?
Okay. So if there are no more questions, everyone's invited to the reception, which will be outside. So we'll see you out there. And let's thank Hans again.